Well, let me say a little bit about the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who I work for. I will just ask, has anyone heard of EFF before? Yes, yes, yes. Well, that's good. That's good. So we are an NGO here in the United States. We have been around for a little over 15 years. And we have been focusing on civil liberties and freedoms online in the digital area. So many people are surprised that we have been around for 15 years, which is quite a bit longer than the internet has been widely available. And so in many ways, we have been focusing on this issue longer than many other NGOs. We're glad to see many others have arisen, CDT, others in the United States. There is now a pretty healthy NGO community focusing on cyberspace, internet-related policy questions. So I'm an attorney, a lawyer with EFF. I want to focus today particularly on copyright, which is an area that I specialize in. As you all know, copyright is coming to each of your countries. There is no question. First, if you want to be part of the European Economic Zone, their system, they are going to demand reforms of your copyright laws. I'm sure this has already begun. The United States, moreover, is going to come and demand that you take steps to increase enforcement and all of this. I'm sure this has already happened as well. I will tell you now that your countries are often synonymous in the United States with piracy. When people talk about where the viruses come from and where all of the bad worms come from, everyone says, it's the Romanians. It's always the Romanians.
Well, life is hard.
Exactly. And from our perspective, you know, this is both good news and bad news. Right. It's good news because it shows that there is a vibrant ICT expertise in many of your countries. It is bad news because, of course, the United States and other countries are going to come to you complaining, always complaining about copyright. It's unlikely you'll ever find the American trade representatives coming to congratulate you about copyright. So we at EFF have had a long experience now thinking about this conflict between copyright and the internet. And we are not opposed to copyright. We in fact think copyright is a good and sensible system. You just have to be very careful that it doesn't interfere with other priorities. And there are three I want to talk about in specific very briefly, and we can have questions as well. One is you have to worry about whether copyright interferes with development. What many people don't know is for the first 100 years of its existence, the United States was known as the Great Pirate Nation. Because the United States, after it broke away from England, made a policy decision, a development policy decision, said, we will not recognize copyrights of foreign nationals, period. We will recognize copyrights for our own authors and our own publishing economy, but when we for the English authors, we are just going to take their works and reproduce them and not pay them a penny. And this made perfect sense from a development point of view. The United States was a net importer of copyrighted works from England. From the United States' point of view, why should they be expatriating, why should they be sending the money of their citizens to England, the country they just broke away from? But of course, the United States continued on this path for a century. And it wasn't until the United States that the economics changed, the United States became a net copyright exporter, that of course we turned the corner and became the world's biggest champions of copyright. So it is important to realize that for a particular country, particularly countries that are trying to develop their own economies, the question of copyright is necessarily connected to the question of development. And so there is this, you have to think about it as a question of what are we getting in exchange for protecting the works of Disney and Time Warner and all of these other countries, many of which have very little incentive to invest in your local economy. Right? It's different in certain ICT areas, there is a quid pro quo, an exchange. They will invest in your economy, you will give them certain rights, when it comes to entertainment and copyright, that issue is often cloudy. It's not to say it never happens. Certainly some software, Microsoft, others, Intel has just announced that they are investing abroad. But it's just something to keep in mind. When copyright owners come and urge you to adopt stronger copyright laws and enforce those laws, to think about it as a question of, does this make sense for our development policy? They will often say that, of course, strong copyright fosters your own creative economy. It encourages your own creators to be involved. That is certainly true, but it also diverts some, you know, depending on whether your citizens are going to want to spend lots of money on Disney DVDs or Hollywood movies or music. You have to weigh that in the equation. So the second area that I think you have to look carefully when you look at copyright. Oh, yeah.
Can I say something about the first point?
Mm-hmm.
What you mentioned is very nice in theory. In practice, always the things are much more difficult. Because first is usually also the position of the national authorities on copyright, copyright office or whatever body, it is, Ministry of Culture, whatever. They do not think in the terms of development, not at all. I mean, this question is not raised or debated in any way whatsoever.
Right.
So often you they said, oh, no, we need to protect the copyright's interest, the copyright owner's interest, and so on and so forth. So it's difficult to start the process from a civil society point of view and to add the points into discussions because sometimes they will even call you an anarchist or something.
Yes, well, we have in some ways exactly the same problem here in that as a civil society group, the groups that are traditionally in charge of copyright, the Copyright Office, we have in Congress a committee that oversees this, tend to be very much very loyal to the copyright industries. But what we have found here, and I would urge all of you to consider this as well, is there are other government agencies and ministries that are in charge of development, in charge of technology policy, in charge of innovation, and you have to build bridges with them and educate them to understand that they have an interest. So that when the government is developing this policy, it is not just the Copyright Office alone. You have to, you want to bring people together because they will find, you create some balance this way. So we, for example, try to get people from the Commerce Committee of our Congress involved in these issues. We try to get the Department of Commerce engaged. And of course we work, and I'll talk about this more in just a second, extensively with our with technology companies and the technology industry so that it is not just one voice on copyright. For too long, copyright has been viewed as a separate issue that only has to do with artists and creators and has nothing to do with the rest of the economy. And that's clearly cannot remain, especially when the conflicts arise on the internet.
Yeah.
So let me just touch briefly on two other areas to watch, and I think you'll see, I agree, the problems are difficult, but I'm happy to talk about concrete strategies about how you address them. The second area where copyright on the internet raises issues is on the area of free speech. It is quite strange to me, as an American, to see that some of the strongest push for more surveillance, for tracking what people are doing, for the kinds of government watching what's going on the internet. A lot of those things are coming most strongly from the copyright debate. So people say, well, there's too much piracy, so the answer is we have to ban anonymous speech on the internet because anonymous speech allows piracy, so we have to ban it. There's too much piracy on the internet, so we have to force ISPs to monitor and track what people are doing. There's too much piracy, so we have to make sure that there's data retention, for example, by ISPs, an issue that's currently very hot in Europe. So we have repeatedly tried to make people understand that although copyright is important, it would be a great shame if copyright were used as an excuse for creating a kind of surveillance infrastructure that could be used for other purposes. Because obviously, and certainly you all are familiar with this, governments have their own reasons for wanting the ability to monitor what people are doing, to trace what they're doing, to retain records, to eliminate anonymous speech. And we all know that those things chill free expression and chill free speech online. If you know that your ISP is keeping records on every website you visit, on every activity you engage in, it changes the kinds of websites you are going to visit. It changes the kinds of activities you engage in. So while copyright is important, I think it's equally important, in my view probably more important, that we do not sacrifice these basic freedoms under this flag of, oh, we must stop piracy, we must stop piracy. So on this, of course, you're right, it is a big challenge, but you need to bring in traditional civil society groups who may not think about copyright, but who think very much about free speech and freedom of assembly and even the political parties, right? And explain to them, you really must stand up and raise your voice if someone is suggesting that ISPs monitor activity for piracy, because of course that exact same infrastructure can be used to monitor anything that anyone wants. And so this is an issue that, again, when people talk about copyright, they often don't think about this question, and I think it should be thought about very seriously.
It's a bit not clear how the free speech links to the copyright issue, especially what you mentioned that the government respects. What is actually the copyright issue there? For example, if some officials make a speech, is it copyrightable? I think no, right?
Well, not here.
Something other issues like. What is the link to the piracy there?
Well, there are two.
From the free speech perspective point.
There are two potential links that I think should be addressed. One is this question of actually copying and manipulating copyrighted content in order to speak about an issue. So this is traditionally, for example, if you want to analyze the news program and you want to reveal the bias in the news, you might copy 20 minutes of the program, put it on your website, and then explain in the website, here is why this was biased. I'm explaining what was left out of the story, all of this. Now, technically speaking, that would be copyright infringement in some places because you made the copy without permission. So any copyright system needs to leave room for this kind of commentary or criticism or these other kinds of activities.
Actually, if you are talking about criticism, it's allowed by the US law. So criticism for the any, even the, you know, books such, you know.
It is.
It's allowed by the US law.
It is.
Interest is how it's linked to the freedom of speech on this context.
Well, technically it is allowed, but my point is to emphasize that be protected, that you permit the kind of criticism and commentary and, you know, remixing and these activities, because that is free speech in the 21st century, right? I mean, these days, if someone wants to reach an audience and to make a point, often they will, you know, be more effective if they can allude to whoever the latest pop star is, or allude to someone in a movie and say, you know, this is either good or bad, or look how ridiculous this person looks, or what it might be. The other issue, though, is even though criticism is permitted in the American copyright system, the reality is it's very difficult for an individual to resist when lawyers working on behalf of a large corporation come and complain. So this is an issue we have in our legal system, this notion that you should be allowed to criticize and make commentary. But on the other hand, we have another system called a notice and takedown for ISPs, where any copyright owner can just send a complaint to an ISP, and then the ISP takes down the website without any court ever looking at it. So even though technically the law says you can criticize, in reality nobody can afford to go to court to fight back when their website is removed by an ISP on this other basis. So,
Fred, I would just add.
There should be some reason, I guess, for the ISP will take down somebody's website. Right,
right, and
there should be some reason.
Yeah, and from our position, the difficulty is a copyright owner will often just give a reason, but oftentimes they're just not, they're not, they're not correct.
Provide any proof as well?
No, you can simply say, you have to say, this activity, we believe this activity is infringing, and that's all.
That's all.
No proof, no opportunity. Now there is.
There is then a process spelled out in the law.
Well, there it's not much of a process.
I'm not going to hold it up as
not much of a process. In fact, the
greatest,
in fact, the process is not required. Right? There is no need. You don't have to, as an ISP, do counter notice. It's entirely effective.
Right.
And so there is this debate. And so, for example, in Canada, the Canadians last year were debating a law and on this same question, and they said perhaps we should do what's called notice. So the copyright owner complains to the ISP. The ISP simply forwards that complaint to the individual, does not take down the website, but forwards it so that the user is aware that the copyright owner objects. And then it's up to the user to decide whether they want to continue because they believe what they're doing is legal, or instead whether they want to take it down. So that hopefully offers a little more protection. Still, many individuals are not willing to fight against a big company on these issues. So these are things we have to worry about in copyright, because even though copyright law might permit criticism and commentary, how does it actually work for an individual who wants to do it? Do they have really the ability to take advantage of this?
And the other thing I was going to add along those lines is just that there are some copyright policies and laws that threaten people's ability to engage in that right that they theoretically have under the law. So as there are different proposals to provide technical protections against copying, and then government enforces that by essentially providing the force of law through anti-circumvention requirements, or I should say anti-circumvention prohibitions, that can, as a practical matter, make it difficult for people to engage in the kind of speech that the law would theoretically allow.
And then the other piece of that is you have to think about, again, imagine from the perspective of an individual how this plays itself out in reality. So in the United States, for example, another area where we have this problem is because the remedies available to a copyright owner are very strong. And so, for example, if a copyright owner sues you and you lose, you are automatically liable for a certain amount of money for every work you infringed. They don't have to show that it actually caused them harm in the market. They don't, you know, so that can often be very frightening. I mean, we often have people who I think are engaged in activity that is permitted under copyright law. But then I have to sit down with them and I have to explain, you know, if we go to court, I cannot guarantee you that we're going to win because, you know, court cases come out lots of different ways. And I think we're going to win. I'm pretty sure we're going to win. I think the law is on your side. But if we lose, it could cost you tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars. You could lose your house. And many individuals say, well, I'm not willing to take that chance. Even if I think I'm 80% likely to win, a 20% chance that I'm going to lose my house, too much. And so you have to think about, in the copyright system, not just does the law permit commentary, but how does it actually work in practice? Does an individual have the ability to fight for their rights, or is it too dangerous, too legally difficult? And so this is something that should be considered. So, as you know,
are you arguing against the copyright law in this respect?
I don't have a problem. For example, you could arrange copyright law so that someone who has a good faith belief that they are within the scope of criticism, particularly if their activity is non-commercial, I think you could say no damages against that individual. You can go to court, you can get an injunction. If the person loses, you can force them to stop. But you can't take their house if they were engaged in something that was non-commercial and was a good faith belief that they were within the exception. So,
particularly because the scope of the exception is fairly vague. As we were discussing the other day when we talked about Google Print, it can be hard to figure out what qualifies and not. So coming down with big penalties if somebody guesses wrong, difficult.
And the other way that this issue intersects with free speech is, as I mentioned, if there is an infrastructure built to monitor and enforce, that can have its own chilling effect on speech. So as I said, if you know that your ISP is keeping records on every website you visit for 6 months or 2 years or however long, that may affect what websites you are willing to visit. It may affect what kinds of speech speech you're willing to engage in, because you know at any time somebody could go back and, you know, find out, oh, well, what were you looking, what were you interested in, or is there anything we can use against you? So that's not directly, it's not that piracy. Well, this is my issue, my what I'm trying to explain is, when the copyright, yes, but when the copyright owners come demanding these things, they are going to demand ISPs do data retention. They are going to demand that they can force ISPs to identify individual users so that they can go after them. These are all issues that become copyright issues. This is sort of my point, is that for too long, people who are thinking about privacy have thought that copyright is just separate. And they are somewhat related, and often people who think, you know, fight for the right to speak anonymously, for example, don't realize that those rights could be taken away thanks to copyright policy. And so this is an issue we're worried about. The third area I just want to touch on briefly, and then we can have just questions, and I'll let David speak on whatever he'd like as well, is the connection between copyright and innovation in the ICT market. This is increasingly, I think, an issue. Copyright owners don't like certain kinds of technologies that, in their view, make too easy for people to make copies. And so most obviously, here in the United States, copyright owners have been suing peer-to-peer file sharing software companies. They've also brought suits in Netherlands, in Australia, in Japan, in Korea. And so clearly that is one kind of technology that copyright owners have been very unhappy about. As a result, here in the United States, and I think soon in Europe as well, copyright owners are arguing that government should take more steps to regulate certain technologies in order to minimize the risk of piracy. They are also arguing that copyright law should reach beyond just the people who make the copies, who engage in the piracy, and should include technology companies who make technologies that the pirates use. And that is a serious problem, I think, for the free market in the ICT area. Because, frankly, the technology companies are trying to build technologies that they think will be maximally useful to the most number of people. And if they have to go and ask permission from copyright owners before they build the product, there will be less innovation, it will be slower. You'll not get the same kind of innovation. So, to take some examples, American movie studios, when Japan, when Sony introduced the first VCR, the Betamax, the Hollywood studios responded by suing to try to say that, we know Sony is not making copies, they just built the machine, but we want to hold Sony responsible for the piracy committed with the machine. And in that case, the United States Supreme Court ultimately said, no, we won't go that far. But today, the copyright industries, particularly the movie studios, are arguing strongly to change that rule. And so in Europe, for example, there's talk now about expanding so-called secondary liability in copyright. When can you, as a technology company, be held responsible for what your users are doing? And that obviously has a real chilling effect on technology innovators who have to now worry, oh, if I build this piece of software, if I build this new device, am I going to end up being sued for copyright infringement just because some of my users may misuse it? I mean, obviously, if that were the rule, the people who make photocopiers would be in a world of trouble. The people who make CD burners would be in all kinds of trouble. You know, it really can chill a broad array of technologies. And this isn't to say that it would stop the technologies, but what it would mean is that the companies who are building these technologies would first have to go and negotiate with Hollywood to try to come to some kind of negotiated deal. And perhaps Intel and Microsoft and Apple can do that, right? They're big enough, these companies return their calls, they can negotiate some kind of deal. But most of the young entrepreneurs in your countries are never going to be able to do that, right? I mean, if some young software person wants to, you know, in Azerbaijan wants to pick up the phone and call Walt Disney Studios, he's going to have a very hard time getting that call returned. And so the worry is that smaller innovators will be particularly harmed if copyright law creates this chill, this sense that if you build the wrong product, we will come get you. And so that's an area we have been very engaged in to try to explain to people. It's one thing to have copyright apply to the people who are actually engaged in piracy. It's a different thing to have it apply to people who are building general purpose devices and software, and to try to keep that line. And as I said, in Europe, this is coming up right now with a real push, I think, in the next couple of years to get secondary liability expanded, some kind of aiding and abetting kind of theory, some idea that we should be able to reach the technology companies. And I always worry in these debates, the copyright owners know that your countries are vulnerable on the piracy issue. And so often they will come to you and they will push you to do things that they know they could not get in Australia or in England or in Germany. And they will try to get it from your countries so that they can use it as a precedent to then use against Germany and Australia and England. So you have to be, this, I urge you to be cautious to not allow these principles to be undermined in your countries just because Hollywood has an agenda in other countries as well. So those are.
Do you have any example how, for example, the entertainment industry or the copyright holder has dramatically influenced technologies in order to prevent piracy?
Absolutely. I mean, we certainly have a situation now where, and some of you may know, in the WIPO copyright treaties that were put together in 1996, which are now part of the EU's copyright system, part of the US system, and increasingly the United States through free trade agreements is pushing it on everybody else. These provisions require that if a work is locked with a digital lock, encrypted or otherwise protected, the law must provide penalties for anyone who undoes the lock. And what this has meant now, for example, you look at DVD. DVD is probably the first and biggest technology to have taken advantage of this. So today, if you want to build a DVD player, any DVD player, you have to go and obtain a license from a consortium that controls the encryption keys that unlock DVDs. All the Hollywood DVDs are encrypted. They are scrambled on the disk. And so in order to unlock that disk, if you are in a country that has anti-circumvention provisions, you have to go and ask permission. And of course, when you ask permission, you get a big, thick licensing contract. And that contract tells you exactly what you can and cannot do with your DVD player. So this is a dramatic change from the VCR, as I mentioned in the 80s, where Sony built whatever technology they thought the market wanted. And you compare the DVD in the 1990s, where to build that player, you get told what features you can offer by the copyright industries, by this consortium that controls the keys. And we will see more of this, right? Of course, next generation high definition DVD, also encrypted. The next generation audio formats, all encrypted. And so this will create an environment where anytime you want to build a technology that plays music or plays movies or touches any of these works, you will have to go ask permission first. And when you ask permission, there will be lots of conditions that will be laid upon you by the copyright owner. Now, in my view, this is a bad outcome for innovation. Of course, copyright owners say that we have to do this to prevent piracy. But as you and I both know, it hasn't done any good for piracy, right? DVD was cracked almost immediately. You can download free DVD copying software from hundreds of places for free. So it hasn't stopped piracy. But what it has done is it has given copyright owners the ability to dictate the feature set, the kind of innovation that a technology company can offer. So this is a clear, in my view, example of the way changes in copyright law have given new control over technology to this one sector. And again, as I said, this is a sector, for better or for worse, that is a sector that is big, largely American companies. But in other words, your local companies aren't going to be able to go to the DVD consortia and say, we would like you to change this and this and this, right? They're going to say, who are you? Why should we listen to you? Our bosses are Disney, Warner Brothers, all of this. So this is an issue, I think, that is something people should think about.
And interestingly, in some of the areas where the content or copyright communities haven't fully been able to exercise that control, such as broadcast television here, simply because it's broadcast in the clear with no encryption, they've been seeking policy solutions through legislation to effectively give them that same kind of control.
It's recent. It's happening now, yes?
Yes.
This is all under discussion. Yeah. It's not clear where this discussion will end up or whether legislation will actually be enacted, but it is clearly the goal of the content industries to close any potential holes where they don't already have control over what new technology will look like.
And in fact, in Europe, countries I'm almost certain we'll all use DVB, which is the digital television standard that's being developed in Europe. The United States uses a different standard, but we're very strange and nobody else in the world likes our standard. So most of the rest of the world will use DVB. And DVB, there are content restrictions being put into that standard right now in inter-industry working groups going on in Western Europe largely. When they're finished and your countries want to update to digital television, you will have only that one choice. And many of the decisions will have already been made regarding content protection and what features can be permitted and all of this. So it is something to consider. And in terms of strategy, because you're exactly right, all of this is good in theory, but what should you do about it? What can the civil society folks do about it? I would urge you to work with other countries that have already found themselves in this same quandary. Because the reality is, US and European trade negotiators are going to come and they're going to say, you must implement our copyright law the way we tell you to, otherwise there will be no free trade for you. And that's very difficult to resist, because no matter how much you care about copyright, I bet you that your mineral industries, your timber industries, your oil industries, they are going to be much more important, and they are going to want free trade very, very much. So you have to think about how you can protect these policies in that context. And in this connection, you have countries like Chile, Australia, Canada, other countries who have been trying to work this exact same compromise, to find a way to protect some of these policies while understanding that if you want free trade, you're going to have to make certain compromises because the United States and Europe are just going to demand it and you're going to have no leverage to change that. So the key, I think, is to talk to the people, you know, in Chile, the others who have already had the free trade agreements, Chile, Australia, Singapore, and learn from their experience and ask, what can we get on the margins to protect these issues that the Americans and the Europeans are willing to give? Because believe me, the Americans and the Europeans, they are coordinated on this, right? They know exactly what they had to give away to Singapore, and they want to make sure they never have to give it away to anybody else. So I think it makes sense for you on the other side to know as much as they do. And to do that, you need to talk to the other people who have been involved. So we've been working on these free trade agreements along with several other NGOs, such as Center for our CPT, Center for
Consumer Project on Technology,
Jamie Love's organization here in the United States. There are a number of NGOs that have been going to WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, for some years, and they have been focusing on some of these questions. So really reach out to some of those NGOs and learn from their experience, I think is the best way.
Yes, speaking about WIPO, unfortunately the general theory of WIPO when they come to your country and discuss with you is not that, you know, we should talk about the development agenda or let's discuss about the free speech or the development of the copyright, even though, if I remember correctly, in one of the Bern Treaty revisions, there were some fair specification for developing countries, but that was not enforcing until the end. But the point is that depending on the country is located, I see three or four factors that influence the copyright policy. Besides the national sector, which sometimes is very weak. So you have the European Union, especially if you're trying to join European Union.
Yes.
And then the discussions are very tough because the bureaucrats from the European Commission are not interested in talking about development, but they are just interested in implementing the European directives word by word. So, well,
they don't bother understanding.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They don't even understand it, but they just want it there.
Yes.
Then you might have, as you mentioned, the WTO. So that's also one case. But you might have WIPO, which in some cases they come directly. And also United States has a very powerful pressure.
Oh, yes.
You probably know that, especially by increasing the piracy rates more than it usually is, because nobody can contest those figures. I mean,
yes, exactly. Well, and of course, I always ask, you know,
yeah,
they say we lost $5 billion in Romania this year alone, and you say, well, wait, do you think every person who downloaded the movie would have paid full retail price? It's like more money than they make in a month, right?
Yeah.
So these numbers are very hard to respond to, but you're right, they're largely fiction. So I agree, these are very hard.
Yes, and it's difficult, at least in Romania, to find somewhere with a different position among authorities. All the authorities are under the direct influence of U.S. enterprises or even government through the U.S. embassy who is trying to push these things forward. And actually, right now, all the legislation is in concordance with the European directives and so on and so forth, but they still complain about piracy because the problem is on the enforcement level and not on the on the legal level. But
this is a real challenge. But I do think, as I said, there are ways on the margins to try to protect some of these other interests. So one thing, I think it is important to try to develop copyright expertise outside of the traditional copyright area. Right? I mean, I have found, even in Eastern Europe, that many of the professors of copyright who are in the law schools are big members of the Copyright Society and of WTO and there's an international copyright organization that, I'm forgetting the name, ALAI in France. And they are very smart and they have great expertise, but their point of view, I think, is sort of determined from one side. And so it's very useful, I think, to find someone with some expertise and develop that expertise. And so perhaps an attorney in private practice, perhaps someone in a ministry, and really try to find a reason for them to develop that expertise, because it's impossible to argue against these people. They know so much about this area, and when you try to debate it, they'll say, oh, but burn section 12 bis 6, you know, and you know, it's very difficult. So you do need to develop that, and perhaps you might also think about inviting scholars and academics from Western Europe to come to your, maybe spend a year or 2 years in a local university and learn some of these issues. I mean, you can say, listen, you can make a big difference influencing Romanian IT policy if you come and learn and help us. But you need that. That's very difficult to do without. And this is why I would point you at the NGOs who have been involved in WIPO, who've been involved in these other forums, because they have that expertise and they can hopefully provide you at least some ammunition to resist. And then, as I
actually the we receive the most support from, of course, the open source community,
yes,
and also small and medium sized enterprises that are not doing probably open source, but they are just interested in being a free market and not to have too many burdens on them.
Well, that's the other important thing I would encourage you to do, as I mentioned earlier. Find the small entrepreneurs, find the companies that are local, and bring them to the ministries. Introduce them, make them understand that there are real local businesses who are endangered or at least implicated by these issues, right? So I always say to people, you know, look at the guys who founded Skype, right? I bet you right now that the policymakers in, you know, I guess the Netherlands is where, sort of hard to know where they're from these days.
Estonia.
Well, yes, the original developers. And As I understand it, in Estonia, you know, one in every three software developers is employed with Skype money, right? I mean, that's, and so, you know, this is the important thing, is if you can have strong business involvement locally, that counts for something, I think, in the right ministry. Right? If you have Hollywood coming on the one side saying, give us what we want, and on the other side you have someone local saying, I'm providing jobs, I'm building a company, then I hope the government ministry can hear that. It's much more effective than just having civil society by itself, if you can bring some of the companies that help.
I will have one question regarding the notice and takedown procedures. I know that in US, I think they've gone too far. I've seen a study where from 10 ISPs that were informed, a big number of them just took down the phone and even it was in the public domain.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you need to have notice and takedown or another procedure that works in case of copyrighted content that has been stolen from another website. Mm-hmm. Because then you might get in the situation where nobody believes in copyright because everything is copied without any...
I agree. So
my question would be, what would be a realistic notice and takedown procedure that could be implemented into a law, or what kind of procedure in a copyright law or other type of law that would work on one hand, and on the other hand, not to create problems or not to create, not to give too much power to the ISPs or to the hosting companies that are just intermediaries.
Yeah, well, this is a very good question and one that I do not think you can give a general answer to. You have to look at the way your national legal system works, because, as I said, here in the United States, forcing an individual to go to court against a large copyright owner is very, very difficult, right? Because our legal system is incredibly expensive. The remedies, if you lose, are very frightening to a typical individual. Different legal systems may operate differently. I don't know how expensive or inexpensive it is, or how long or short it takes to go to court in each of your countries.
I think right now we're on the other side. The law is so loose that everyone talks too much, you know. So, and on the other hand, people don't want to go to trial because you might get in front of a trial that would last 1 year or 2 years. So a company will get their copyrighted content stolen. I mean. Not just one page. I mean, like whole website.
Yes. Oh,
and
I understand.
Then you have you might arrive in front of a judge that does not understand what internet is.
Yes.
So you've got much more problems.
Well, then you should consider then private mechanisms that might resolve some tension. So you could have a situation, for example, as David mentioned, we tried in our law to create a system where we could have notice. And then the individual could counter notice if they felt that what they were doing was legal. I don't think the way we've implemented it worked very well, because most people don't know that they have the right to counter notice. The counter notice procedure is not mandatory on ISPs. So there could be a way you could set it up so that a copyright owner could provide notice. The other party would have a certain period of time to respond. You could have some way, then you have to decide. If the person doesn't respond, then you, I assume, can take it down. And if they respond in a way that's false, you might want to create some opportunity for some penalty. Not so much that they, you know, lose their house so free speech is stopped, but enough that, you know, they feel the pain a little bit. Maybe just something as simple as cutting them off from the internet for 30 days or something. You have to try to find this balance. And again, as I said, because each country's legal environment is different, I think you have to think hard about, on the ground, how is it going to work.
But certainly some kind of administrative procedure that is short of a whole court case seems essential.
Yeah.
Isn't some serious differences in the copyright approach United States and Europe. Why it's important? Because many of our countries try to be a part of the European Union.
Yes.
That's why we have a general direction to synchronize, to approximate our legislation in respect of copyright to European standard, to European declaration. And as we see the
necessarily different often repeated different declaration, different directive from the European Union. It's sometimes this come to conversion, heavy conversion each to other. Yeah. That's why it's very difficult, and it's very difficult to understand it, difficult to implement it, this rule, this recommendation to the national law.
Yeah.
That's why sometimes there are no clear understanding what should be done at the local and from the other side, at which is leader should be for us. United States cooperative system or the European Union?
Well, there certainly is. There are important differences between the American system and the European system. However, I think now there is more and more commonality developing, because you have, I think, the United States and Europe now more in agreement. You have the WIPO copyright treaties, the WIPO internet treaties that are they're not exactly the same, but they're very close. But I do think there are some parts of the European system that are superior to ours, at least potentially superior. And in one in particular that I think all of your countries should think about is the private copying regime. Europe has traditionally had a general private non-commercial copying mechanism. So if you want to make a copy of a CD on an iPod, or you want to make a photocopy of an article for your own use, that's all right. There is specific permission. And usually some sort of a royalty or levy system is involved to try to compensate copyright owners for that.
On the equipment that it wore, or the media on which it would be recorded.
And in my view, that system has some advantages. Because it clarifies some basic relationships for individuals, right? In the United States, for example, we don't really know whether it is legal to make copies for your own personal use. I think it is. Copyright owners say it's not. Most of these issues you'd need to go to court to answer. It creates unnecessary complexity and uncertainty. I think private copying has the advantage in Europe of at least giving certainty for everyday individual uses, which seems to me to be good, because that way at least people know I can make this copy for my own personal non-commercial use and I'm not violating the law.
Is it including the MP3 file as well? Is it including MP3 file as well?
Yes, in Europe. In Europe. So Germany, for example, just updated its laws to comply with the European directive and made it clear that if you buy a CD, you have the right to make a personal copy of that CD on your iPod or what you like.
I'm talking about the downloading MP3.
Now, that's...
Is it file sharing, as it says, illegal now?
Well, yes, this is, yes. In Europe, there have been changes...
Depending on the country.
Depending on the country, exactly. This is still subject...
This is not the European Union law. This is some laws from some particular countries. Depending on the country, that's why...
Yes. Yes, I don't.
There is the.
Is it in the directive?
There is a directive, the IPR enforcement directive. It has something that will make the countries to implement this article, in the sense that action peer-to-peer is illegal. I mean, I think it's more uploading files than downloading files.
Yes, but the focus has been more on uploading.
But it's already.
This is the making available, right?
Yeah, it is a tricky issue because France is right now in the process of adopting their copyright law in accordance with the European directives. And, they have a very nice discussion in the lower chamber on if to put. A fixed fee on internet access if you want to use then you can use peer-to-peer as much as you like. Well, this provision did not stay in the draft law until the end, but at least I think it raised the discussion, and probably other European countries might pick up on that. So it is not very clear in all the legislation.
And in the US it's just free for each downloading file so far, right?
Well,
if you want to download some MP3, you should pay some amount.
Yeah, in the US we have, of course, the the legitimate markets.
Illegal, right?
Right. It, basically, yes. At least that's where the courts have come out so far. And over, for any who don't know, over 20,000 individual Americans have been sued in court for downloading without permission. And in each of those lawsuits, they're usually settled before trial because, as I said, our legal system is so expensive that regular individuals really can't afford it. And they're usually settled for about $3,000 to $4,000.
Even the file sharing is illegal.
Yes.
How did they find out who is downloading what?
And this is, of course, where the privacy question comes into play. So the copyright owners are able to determine the IP address of people who are file sharing. And then they go to the ISP, they file a lawsuit, and then they get a subpoena, a legal process, delivered to the ISP, and they say, ISP, tell us who the person is behind this IP address. And then the ISP has to hand over the name, and then they go and they say, we got you, pay us $3,000 or we will sue you, and for the most part, people pay.
And this is kind of association with dealing with all these things, right?
The recording industry group, yes, RIAA.
Is it, what is it? Is it, what kind of body is it? Is it? It's not the government structure, right? It's just the private institution, NGO, right?
Well, it's a little complicated. It is nominally the recording companies themselves. When you are caught as a file sharer and you are sued, in the lawsuit is the name of the recording companies, Sony, Virgin, EMI, Capitol, whatever it is. But the entity that is coordinating the effort on their behalf is the Recording Industry Association of America, which is an industry group that represents all the big record labels. So they are the ones who are sort of the brains behind the effort. But it is being implemented by individual lawyers being paid by the record companies privately. So there has been no government or very little government involvement. There have been, to my knowledge, only two criminal prosecutions of people for simple downloading, uploading activity. So far the criminal issue has been kept largely out of play. Nobody's going to jail in the United States for file sharing. They are being forced to pay, but not going to jail, which I think is important, because in Italy, for example, people are going to jail, and I think that really is completely disproportionate to the offense. So, but yes, in Europe, this is a question about just how much room is there to allow downloading as a question of private copying. In Canada, for example, most people think that downloading is permitted as part of the private copying right. Uploading is a different question. The WIPO treaties, for example, require, and the European directive also requires, that countries give copyright owners an exclusive making available right. Exclusive making available, right. So generally uploading is prohibited as part of that. Frankly, this is a huge issue that we're going to have to resolve eventually, file sharing, because it's going to keep on happening. Right, there are tens of millions of people doing it. This shows no indication of diminishing. How many
U.S. persons are still using illegal file sharing system? No, just an estimation.
It's very hard to know. I would estimate roughly 20 million.
Okay, I will use this figure.
The numbers, exactly. And this is a figure, there is a group.
The source.
Exactly.
No, without the source. No, we found out in U.S. that
20 million. And there is a source. There is a group called the Pew Internet and Society Project, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
They do surveys.
Pew Project for Internet and Society.
Yeah, Pew Project for Internet and Society. And they do surveys, and their most recent surveys suggest roughly 20 million people continuing to download.
But do they make the difference between illegal download and legal download? Because there are some services in the U.S. that allow them to download.
Yeah, no,
sure,
there are no...
And participation in those is going up very quickly.
Yeah. But most of the evidence suggests that when people buy downloads from iTunes or from these other legitimate services, they don't stop their illegal downloading. They do both, right? Which is pretty amazing if you think about it, right? They could get it for free, but they pay because it's more convenient and it's easier and it's higher quality or whatnot. But they generally don't give up the P2P. If they can't find it, on Apple or on one of these, then they say, okay, I can't find it, now I'm going to go get it someplace else. So, you know, and
maybe it's also a real return to the producer or to the author of the work. Maybe it is, I mean, I pay only the real music that I like. I mean, maybe I listen to 100 CDs, but I like just one. It's really worth the money. The rest is just crap. I delete it and I just occupy space.
There's some of that, no doubt, as well. It's this is also going to have a differential impact depending on the wealth of your public. Right. I mean, in Europe, for example, they're setting the price. I think the Apple Store in Europe is 99 cents. I mean, whatever, is it cents for euros?
Yeah, euro cents.
You see, 99 euro cents, or maybe 79 euro cents.
I don't know, but it doesn't work in all the countries.
Right.
There are some countries,
right,
in Romania and where you cannot download music.
Right. And even if it, right, and even if it,
there's no legal service at all.
They opened one, I think, 3 months ago, but only with Romanian music. So if you want to download a CD from a Romanian website, you cannot do that.
And so, of course, the reality is people are going to continue to download. People are going to continue to exchange CDs on hard drives. You know, it's going to become cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And people are, it's just going, we're going to need a different solution. You cannot expect people are going to spend 79 euro cents for every song they download. That's just crazy, right? I mean, to fill one of these devices at that price would cost you thousands of euros, right? It's just, it makes no sense. So eventually a different system will have to evolve, but I think we're still several years away. I think a collective system makes the most sense, where you pay a certain amount, whether it's in your broadband bill, or whether it's on devices, or whether it's directly, or however it is, I think most people will pay some additional monthly amount, and in exchange, they will be allowed to download whatever they like. That to me seems the only sensible alignment of incentives. Right? That way, the more people are copying, the more people are downloading, the more money the recording industry makes from these this small incremental fee, and that way, hopefully, the war.
But certainly,
will
so
end.
Far, the recording industry
they're not
is far from
yet.
Embracing that idea.
Not interested yet.
But I want two questions. First, do you know of any case of a natural person that has been sued in the US and has won the process against
Yes.
Recording agency?
Yes.
What was the reason?
Well, whenever you sue 20,000 people, you are always going to sue some people by mistake. And so there have been some people who were sued who actually, they got the wrong person. They were completely innocent. And some of those have been dismissed. Not many, maybe less than a handful. There have been some other situations. Normally, the person who gets sued is the parent of a child. Right, so usually in the home there's broadband, the mother or father is paying for it, and so when the ISP identifies the person, it's the name of mom or dad, and of course
they don't even know that their child is
right,
engaging in file sharing.
It was the teenager who was doing it, and there's been at least one case where the parent has said, "I didn't do it. You can't sue me." And the recording industry has said, okay, fine, we will sue your teenage daughter instead. And they did so. But then the court said, okay, now you have to appoint someone to represent the daughter. And the recording industry refused to pay for that. And so the case got dismissed. So there are these strange situations, but there is no case where the court has said downloading is legal or anything like that. It's been individual circumstances. And as I said, the majority of people settle because it's just cheaper and easier to pay $3,000 than it is to fight. And as far as we're aware, this process is profitable for the RIAA. They are covering their costs in these lawsuits. The settlements pay for the next round.
And I know that in US there have been some cases where the producers of file sharing system have been sued. The Crosstalk case is probably the most well known.
That was my case.
Ah, okay. Then you, I know that it was a Supreme Court decision on that, but I think that the case returned to a lower court.
It's true.
Was it the final decision on the case? And if you know of other file sharing producers that are being sued?
There have been many lawsuits against the software companies that make file sharing software, beginning most famously with the Napster case, which was brought in 1999. What is interesting is none of these cases has actually gone to trial and been finally resolved. So the Napster case, for example, the court shut Napster down while the trial was pending, but then before it was completed, Napster ran out of money and went out of business. Similarly, there was a lawsuit brought against Aimster, which was another file sharing. Same thing happened. They ran out of money. They went bankrupt before there was ever a final ruling. There was the Grokster case, as you mentioned, is still continuing in California. The Supreme Court decision, the Supreme Court said you can be held liable if you are encouraging and inviting copyright infringement. And then the court said, but now we have to go back to the lower court to see whether this company actually did that. So that's where they are. So there have been many other lawsuits brought that have been settled immediately because the companies have been too small to fight. So Audio Galaxy, iMesh, and several others as well, I think. And frankly, I think this litigation is probably not going to happen very much anymore because the companies that are left are too small and too poor to fight back against these much wealthier opponents. So Kazaa is still being sued in California in the same case with Grokster. So they are still left. But other than Kazaa, I don't think anybody has enough money to really fight.
There are a lot of small, sometimes beware programs that have been released just one time, and then nobody produced them anymore. And there are more and more. I mean, I think right now there are at least 100 peer-to-peer.
More than that. Programs. Definitely more than
that. What about open source peer-to-peer programs?
There's plenty of those, right? I mean, LimeWire is one that's relatively well known. It's open source. Works quite well, being used by millions of people. There's no way to stop this software, right? You can wipe out all the companies. You can sue all the commercial entities that have assets and bank accounts and offices, but you can't stop the software. It's already available. It's available everywhere for free. It's open source so that anyone can continue to develop and add to it and republish it. This software is not going away. More importantly, this software has many good uses that we are beginning to see. Companies are commercializing this technology for purposes other than sharing music and movies. So I just saw in the newspaper last week, there are three companies that are using peer-to-peer to help people share photographs with their friends and families. Because it's easier than uploading your pictures to a central website and all of this. Instead, you will just put them in your local computer. You will tell other people how to connect directly to your computer. It cuts out the middleman. Seems like a very good idea to me. So the technology is going to be with us no matter what. So it's been a long, should we take a break? Do you want to hit up with other stuff? We got another about 40 minutes, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have anything else specific to add. I guess I'd echo just a lot of what Fred said about, the different kind of concerns that he ticked through, I guess, are just reasons why when you approach copyright law and policy, it's important to be trying to work towards a balanced solution that includes all these different considerations. Because I think too often, and we often see it here, people think of the purpose of copyright law is simply just to protect the interests of copyright creators, and that's really the only interest people have in mind, and it does in fact affect all these other areas. I guess it depends if there's anything else specific. I know we had talked a little bit about Google Print the other day, and that was kind of cut short because I had a time constraint. If there was anything further on that or on any other particular issues that folks want to talk about?
I think it would be important if you could highlight also some official statements, documents, declarations that can help us support the position in relationship with copyright owners. I mean here not only on the issues that you mentioned, on big companies coming and supporting our position, but also in, for example, promoting more the public domain as a keyword in the copyright field, or I don't know, taking into consideration the open source software when talking about general copyright protection. So always not just think about computer programs, okay, we got Microsoft. No, think Microsoft, freeware, hardware, whatever.
Yeah.
And it could be relevant for us, and I think that this is what actually makes more sense to the people that you're talking to. If you find any kind of peer declarations or recommendations from international bodies or from one country or another, why not? Or even good examples from other countries. Sometimes it works.
Good. Yeah, I agree. Unfortunately, you're not likely to find very many good documents of that kind from this country.
From official sources.
Right, from, right, from the government.
Where you'll find it will be from certain corners of academia where people are writing about it from, right. From groups like ours.
I'll give you one example now, which you may have seen. We at EFF publish a report that we update that describes all of the reported abuses of these anti-circumvention provisions that were put in our law by the WIPO copyright treaty. So this has been used to try to protect the market for garage door openers. It has been used to attempt to block refilling of printer cartridges. It's been used to try to stop independent service vendors from servicing computer equipment. It's been used for lots of anti-competitive purposes, not to stop piracy, but to stop competition. And so we have been documenting all of these misuses of the law in an effort to make, hopefully, our own policymakers understand that they went too far, but also to help other countries who are being asked to implement this as part of the European directive or a free trade agreement or whatever it might be, what some of the risks are, so that you can say, you know, we need to be sure, we may implement this, but we should implement it in a way that doesn't end up harming competition or harming other other issues.
So where are you now with Are you still have them at the there?
Yes, we still have it in the same form that was passed in 1998. I am actually somewhat optimistic that within the next 3 to 5 years we may see some changes. I think people have recognized that there are certain ways in which the DMCA went too far, particularly in the area of competition.
So you think that the articles about out of the?
Well, let me be clear.
No.
It'll still be in there. We may get some more, a new exception, or we may get some broader exceptions. But the other thing to keep in mind, and this is something that the Americans and the Europeans will never tell you, the WIPO copyright treaties do not require implementation exactly like our implementation. In fact, our own bureaucrats, our own government officials admitted when the law was passed that our law went beyond what the WIPO copyright treaty requires. So it is not, you can be a signatory to the WIPO copyright treaty and still implement in a different way. So this is something.
Fred, if I remember it correctly, the WIPO copyright treaty is actually very basic
very
on
vague.
This point, right?
It
simply says that you have to have effective legal protections against circumvention. Doesn't really say what those are. Certainly does not say that you can't have exceptions for cases when it seems to be misused for competitive purposes or where it may conflict with other values like fair use issues that we have here or private copying issues that they might have in Europe.
Unfortunately, when the United States comes and negotiates a free trade agreement, they will say, you will implement it just like we implemented it. We don't care whether it's beyond the copyright treaty or not.
Exactly, this is happening in many countries.
Many countries.
Russia already does exactly the same.
And so this is why the key for what we have discovered in looking at this area is there is some room to negotiate the margins of this. And as I said, I think Australia is particularly interesting in this regard because they are they had previously enacted their own national legal regime for this area. The United States came in with a free trade agreement and said, you have to redo it, and you have to redo it the way we tell you to redo it. And the Australians are not too happy about that. And so they are trying to find some different approach. And so whatever they do could be very helpful for other countries, because you can say, listen, we're doing what Australia did. Australia isn't a bunch of renegades. They're, you know, developed country, part of the, you know, copyright community. And similarly, Canada is also right now evaluating alternate implementation ideas. And so I think it's very important that for the entire, you know, developing world, that everyone get together and support these countries, because if they are able to stake out a new position, all of you will be able to hopefully get some advantage from saying, you know, we want the same deal Australia got, or the same deal that, you know. So you're all really on one side of this, and so it's, I think, beneficial to try to coordinate. And, you know, you see this in WIPO already, where you have the development agenda, you have countries on the other side working together to say, you know, together we have some negotiating leverage. If we're all separated, we have no leverage. The United States will just come and tell us what to do, and we won't be able to change anything.
I do think one potential factor is that it is true that over time, as we've had some experience under the U.S. law, you get some ability to amass evidence of ways that it has proved problematic. And so that's what Fred's talking about. His organization's put out a paper like that. Cato Institute recently did a good paper on it. So we don't really have official documents in the U.S. saying it, but there's been enough time here under the law for some think tanks and advocacy organizations to take a careful look at the problems. So I think it's a little easier to have some evidence behind a case for not doing it exactly the way the U.S. has done it than it would have been a few years ago.
But I still think we are a few years away from any real change here, because I think the pressure is building, but it has not built up enough yet.
Yeah, this is quietly enough for other countries to adopt Armenia. This article is exactly the same thing. It will be too late.
Yeah.
So what you're saying, that everyone should get together and help that country to make a different opinion, means that you will be available for some pro bono work to assist that country in order to settle if any one of us will have an issue of preventing.
Yes.
We could turn to your expertise.
Yes. In fact, there is. We have one attorney at EFF who her entire focus is international copyright. And in particular, she has been focusing on the free trade agreements and the DMCA circumvention provisions there. And we have been working extensively with Latin American countries because they were the next free trade agreements. There was CAFTA, there was a number of free trade agreements in Latin America. And we are also working with Australia and Canada, and it's exactly to share our expertise that we have developed her position. Now, I don't, you know, I hope we continue to have enough money to support her position, but that is our current, you know, I sympathize with all of you who said to Google, how about giving us some money? I've been saying the same thing for years. So, it is always a challenge, but we believe that this international issue is very important. Finding others who are willing to give us money for it has proven a little more difficult.
What do you think about Creative Commons? How do you think that this, let's call it a movement, will influence the copyright area?
I love Creative Commons. We are big supporters. They are just across town from us in San Francisco. Larry Lessig, who is the founder of Creative Commons, is also on our board of directors as well. So we have, you know, deep ties to that community. I think it's a great thing. It's not a complete solution, but it makes the very important point that copyright is not just for the Walt Disneys of the world. It's also for the individual photographer, the web designer. You know, it educates people about how copyright is overreaching. I always say to people, many creators have no interest in having the same copyright protection that Walt Disney Company has. Right? If you are an amateur photographer, you don't need copyright that lasts 100 years, that allows you to sue anybody for thousands of dollars, that, you know, I mean, what you do, however, want some basic protection. And so I think Creative Commons makes copyright relevant for regular people in a way that supports the copyright system. While at the same time, I think making people realize that there is copyright and then there is Walt Disney copyright.
And it's particularly important now just because digital technologies enable a lot more people to become creators and to distribute creative works broadly, just because of all the tools that digital technologies and the internet provide. So you want ways for them to be able to use copyright without going all the way to Disney's approach.
And just set some basic ground rules, right? I mean, one of the exciting things, I think, for your countries in particular, especially the extent to which your countries have individual languages that are not widely spoken in the rest of the world, the locally created content that's being uploaded by people, videos, music, blogs, in your local languages, could be very, very powerful. I mean, there could be lots of people, this could be a lot of content that people otherwise have never experienced before. It's important, I think, to offer those kinds of amateur creators a way to set the rules, to say, go ahead, feel free to reuse my song as long as it's non-commercial, or feel free to use it as long as you give me attribution. It sort of empowers amateur creators in a way I think is very important. I mean, even here in the United States, people are beginning to say that amateur creativity is likely to be more important and more influential in the next 10 years than the stuff that's on television, you know, the mainstream big media stuff. I mean, Yahoo just announced they were reorienting their whole business to take advantage of amateur-created content. Photographs, short videos, all of these kinds of content.
Well, the statistics on YouTube, I forget what they are exactly, but I mean, a relatively new website that's letting people load up relatively short videos, usually 10 minutes and less, an amateur, and their traffic has just exploded and continues to.
And again, this, if this material is created in local languages, it's, I think, you know, more applicable, more relevant for local audiences than watching, you know, CNN or something.
I think that sometimes with Creative Commons it's very important also the possibility to translate the some documents or papers that are already done in English. So the research has already been done, so if you really want to put the content in the local language, it's much easier. You just need to translate. If you have that Creative Commons license, it's much easier to do that.
Yep.
But speaking about copyright, I think it's also important, especially in our countries where the copyright, I think, is not too well known. As in, what it means, what are your rights, what are your obligations, what's fair use of the exact limitation. I think this also gives an opportunity to explain the copyright to people in the right way. So not just someone has the copyright for his/her life and then 70 years, but also that if you're a creator, you might have some limitations. Or you can set some limitations on your copyright length that you can make use of the work in the limits that the law presents. And unfortunately, I haven't seen any document that will present this so the copyright in this new life. So something very basic, but that will take into consideration also consumers' rights, fair use or limitation of the laws.
You should write this document.
Well, I don't have the time to do that. No, actually, I've been writing some articles in Romanian about public domain, because what I saw that in the Romanian copyright law, the words public domain are not there. So that it is only in the doctrine, so other people have wrote about it. And I wrote about why is the public domain important in the copyright law.
Good.
But write something, 100% on what is copyright and what are the limitations, I think it's not an easy job to do.
It's not an easy job, but it's very important. And it's also important that it be written by someone who can see both sides. Because I guarantee you, Hollywood will be willing to write this document for you. But it's not going to say what you want it to say. So we have the same problem here, where a lot of the information intended for regular people about copyright is very one-sided because it's prepared with money from the entertainment industries. So the message is always about how you must pay, it's downloading is stealing, it's like shoplifting, it's very one-sided message. And that's what you get if you allow that material to be developed by one side.
Yeah.
So add that to your list.
Apart from writing viruses.
Viruses is not my specialty. I write Trojan horses.
That's right. So. Good. Okay, well, all right. We've been going a long time. Yeah. Thank you very much for your attention.